Welcome back. Another episode of Through the Web Podcast with me, Tosif.
Hi. And me, Degogo. Yeah. So we had a bit of a hiatus, well, in ways, I guess, from the studio, because as you probably know, I have had COVID. And now I'm back on track and ready to rumble.
Awesome. It seems like you lost your voice for a bit a few weeks ago.
Not lost my voice. It was just a bit scratchy and horsey, yeah, but it's all right now.
Fair enough. But it feels good to be back in the studio. I think the energy difference is always good to see Braden,
yes.
Which you can't see. So
clap for Braden.
100%. He makes everything tick around here. Mm-hmm. So it's good to have the energy in the studio. And mm-hmm. We did a remote one last week, which was interesting.
Yeah,
which, it wasn't too bad, but this still feels way better.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Hope you guys enjoyed the last one. If you did, let us know. Speaking of which, we got some comments to go over, don't we?
Yeah, we do. But first, I want to share my disappointment.
Oh.
Okay. And it's actually related to a comment from Malik Walker. So that's my comment of the week where he asks, have you guys tried the Pixel Coke drink? Love your guys' channel. I'm not disappointed at you, Malik. That's not the disappointment. Disappointment is on Coke Pixel because I was one of the first people to put in my email address. They did reach out saying that, yep, you can get it. I've done everything that I could to get it, but you can only get it in the United States.
Of course. Of course. That's always the case.
I was so annoyed. And I actually did this earlier last month. So, and then I forgot about it. I forgot about mentioning it in the podcast. But I was really looking forward to doing a taste test and getting it here. You can get them on Amazon, but it's just not worth getting a few.
Maybe that could be our long-term goal. But by episode
25 or something.
We'll try it. We'll have to try the.
Yeah. So, and I looked back at other ways of getting it. Unfortunately, we can't. But if any of you have it, I don't know, just send it to us.
Yeah.
And then we'll send something back to you. Maybe some Cold Fusion merch back at you as a thank you. But other than that, very disappointed I couldn't get my hands hands on it. So.
Right. Okay.
How are you? What's your comment of the week?
My comment is from David. He says, I'm a picky person and you guys' podcast is on my very short list. Thank you. So that means a lot, you know. There's a lot of podcasts out there. And
yeah, a lot. It's one of the fastest growing media outlets, I guess. This is a thing as well, like two guys talking about podcasts. It's like a...
Well, that's the thing.
It's a meme at this point.
Yeah, but all you really do, so specifically talking about podcasts, all you really need to do is have a mic and an internet connection. So I guess the barrier to entry is quite low. So.
Yeah, and we talked about Podfade a few episodes ago, which is 6 to 8 episodes in. People do them and then forget about it and then don't do it anymore. So we've continued. So it's good to see we're off that demon in the podcast world. But you obviously had to stay indoors for the mishap. Mm-hmm. Do you end up watching anything interesting?
Well, yes, actually. There was a piece by Vox. Yeah, pretty sure it was Vox. And it was about the music industry in terms of like TikTok. You've seen the video, haven't you?
I have, and it's my thing that I watched this week as well. That's fine. We'll talk about it.
Let's talk about it. So obviously this has come after the news of what was that artist that was held ransom by a record label?
Halsey,
yeah, that's right. So this came after the news of Halsey, and then I guess it's kind of a thing thinking about how TikTok works with the music industry now. And I think it's interesting that TikTok's done what it's done, because for the first time it's taken the power away from record labels to an extent and given it to the individual creators. So for the first time, they're kind of having some leverage. So I think it's quite fascinating that TikTok can blow up people so massively. Yeah. It's like, you know, people getting hundreds of thousands of streams in the hundreds of millions for some people. Yeah. And it's like the first thing that they've ever put out, and that just wouldn't happen like any other way. I think that's the first time that we're seeing this kind of phenomenon happen. So
yeah, and what I loved about the video so much as well is how data-driven it was. So basically sat down, made Excel sheets and really went through. And I think that's what journalism is about. It's not just about an opinion, but you go back and try and pick up as much statistics as possible, have the objective view and then maybe add your own subjective viewpoint towards the end of the of the thing. So I loved how deep they went with that. And what was interesting about the video was the record label, so the record deals that happened, how there's the trope of an advance.
Yeah.
So basically for those who haven't watched it, do watch it. But the idea of it is that once they sign you, they give you an advance check of, say, $50,000. And part, like 85% goes to the record label and you get 15% of it. But then basically you have to pay that money back to them through the advance that they're going to, the advance is basically a loan of like $1 million. And you basically have to make that $1 million on top. And then once you've made that amount back for the label, you get to keep anything on top. So basically you get into this whole debt straight away. And it works for some people. And the interesting thing is I asked a friend of mine who's an up-and-coming indie artist, and he's based in Bangladesh, but he's got like fans around the world. So he's done well in terms of getting into that global scene. But I asked him that, you know, what did you think about this video? And he said, yeah, I loved this angle because he's on TikTok. He uses TikTok a lot as well to drive numbers. And he said that it's you can't really know if a deal is good or bad until a few years have passed.
Right.
So maybe even though the video is great, but it's also very, you know, like recent, like it'll use a lot of recent numbers rather than a longer term kind of thing.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see maybe revisiting these numbers or these artists maybe 5 years from now and seeing where they're at, because these deals are a very long term rather than in a short term kind of thing. But as you said, like TikTok's what they've done with the whole idea of taking the power away from labels has been fascinating to see.
Yeah, it's an interesting shift. But I have to, you know, I'm not on TikTok. I don't really, you know, but it will be interesting to see like if this actually shifts the music landscape in terms of like how music sounds like will it get shorter? Will the hooks come like right at the beginning? Like will things kind of shift around in terms of like composition, you know? Like,
I think it's already happening because I think we spoke
about the radio and
of how the medium shapes the content. So I think a lot of the artists that do that think about like how it's going to perform on socials. Will people dance to it? Will people use it in certain ways that will make this go viral, right? So I think it's already doing that. But I think it's also created this other, you know, angle of this other pool of musicians who don't care about that and just still do that. Because there's this artist they featured towards the end of that video who said this one line, which was fascinating. He's like, the greatest problem of the labels right now is that I'm not 19, and that's a nightmare for them.
Yeah.
Because he's 30 something and he's making his music and they can't put him into these boxes.
Yeah.
He just wants to do his stuff and still go viral.
Yeah.
So that was great to see that how some, there's like new, different independent artists who wouldn't have been able to do what they do without TikTok. So it's crazy.
Yeah, for sure.
It's crazy. Yeah. Good video. Other thing I watched was Top Gun.
Oh, okay. How was that?
It was great.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. The funny thing is I didn't watch the first Top Gun prior.
Okay.
So on my way to the cinemas, I was on the Uber, like I was in the Uber looking up the synopsis of the first Top Gun film on the way to the movie. Yeah. And it didn't hinder my experience. In some ways, it actually made my experience better. The reason why I bring this the movie up, and if you're one of those people like me who don't want anything like out of the movie as a spoiler, so this is your warning. Maybe skip 30 seconds.
Okay, all right.
But this part, it's not a big spoiler or anything, but they have Val Kilmer on the film. He was also part of the first film. But for those who don't know, Val Kilmer is a legendary actor in Hollywood. He has lost his voice through throat cancer, so he can't speak anymore. So they had to feature him in this film, and he had a couple of lines in there, and it was all AI generated with his own voice.
Yeah.
And that was a great use of AI within the film. And I just loved how they almost naturally included him and used his voice, and it sounded like his voice, but also paid almost like a nod to the fact that he's ill.
Yeah.
So that was a great use of technology into films.
Yeah, interesting. Because you say that, because I'm just thinking when you said that, it reminded me of the new season of Stranger Things. I don't know if you
haven't seen it yet.
Okay. So I'm not going to give any spoilers away or anything, but there's parts where Eleven is seeing her. Well, you know who Eleven is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She's seeing herself, there's parts of herself that are in the past. So, you know, obviously I think it would be, well, extremely foresight to like film that, like, 5 years in advance whatever. So I think that was a deep fake that they used to do. So they had another child actor and put her face in it. And I think I could tell a little bit.
Interesting.
But I think that if that is the case, that's another great use of AI in filmmaking. So
good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, that's the stuff that we watched and did this week. Moving on, you released a new video yesterday.
I did, yes.
It's very fresh. It hasn't been 12 hours.
Just over 12 hours.
I didn't end up watching it yet, but it's about plastics and how an AI-generated enzyme is eating up plastic. So walk me through it briefly, what's it about, and maybe we can run through some comments
that came from it. So in nature, there turns out to be a particular bacteria that eats plastic, uses it to power its cells, and then releases carbon dioxide and the basic components of plastic as the byproducts. So essentially some scientists in 2016 isolated the enzyme within that bacteria that was doing that. And so from there, they were like testing out the enzyme and everything, and they're finding out that it didn't really work that well because, you know, if the temperature was too high or too low or the pH wasn't at the right acceptable level, then it wouldn't really work. So then what happened was in May, so last month, there was a group of scientists at the University of Texas that found that they could use an AI algorithm to increase the performance. So essentially what they did was they, you know, made it learn what makes a protein stable, and they, you know, like 20,000 examples it like learned from, and then they gave it the new enzyme essentially. And so looked at the proteins in those and found that, you know, the amino acids needed to fit like a certain way. And essentially, like, it increased the stability of it. So now it works at lower temperatures, it's faster.
Right.
And so, like, this is the first iteration of it. But, you know, obviously they can keep going with AI, everything's exponential. So I guess that's the essential synopsis of the video. There was a lot of different ranging comments on what people had.
Yeah.
A lot of people, just because AI was in there, they're like, it's going to take over, it's going to start eating people. And it's like, I can't really say anything to that.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, is it going to start eating?
No.
Okay. So that's some assurance. But that's what they all say before they start eating us. So.
But
that's literally the.
But look, AI is a tool. It's not sentient. Yeah. It's not, you know, it's just optimization.
That's what they want you to think. cool. It'll be interesting to see the video as well and how it drives the future. Do you actually think it could potentially be the end of plastic pollution the way we know it, or it's still far from it?
I don't think so. I think it's an aid in reducing the amount of energy input in recycling for sure. Because if you could do this at room temperature instead of having a furnace to burn it or doing other processing, you could just put this or put all the plastic in the, you know, in the vat. And then essentially, like, you have the components to just make it again. And the quality will be higher because it's like the essential amino acid chains. So it's like, you know, you're basically making the plastic again instead of going through this process where it's like, you know, it's warped or like has holes in it or whatever. So I think, it's great for recycling. But in terms of just like the general use of it, like putting it on a stockpile of just like waste, I don't necessarily think so because one of the the amino acids that come, not the amino acids, but the, constitute components that comes out from this bacteria is essentially antifreeze. So like it's the chemical for antifreeze, which is not very good, you know, in terms of like toxicity and everything. So that's what's stopping it from just being used everywhere. Scalable, so it's kind of just like for recycling. But the thing is like I don't know specifically, but it might be possible that they could tweak it so that the components that come out are actually not as toxic. So that would be the ideal goal, essentially.
Okay. So it does seem like there's, with a few tweaks, maybe it can be scalable down the line.
Yeah.
But for now, it's still just being...
for recycling. But even that in itself is a huge...
Huge breakthrough. Yeah, for sure. Well, awesome topic. Mm. Can't wait to see the video. Moving on, just wanted to touch on this story. It's less a story, but more of a milestone or a landmark. It's been 100 days since the Ukraine invasion. The Ukraine war. Right now, obviously, things have kind of are still moving on. We don't get to see it as much on the news. Interesting enough, when we started the podcast, that's just the same week it started happening.
Yeah, that's true.
So we were covering the first few episodes a lot about the war, but not so much now. And I think that also shows maybe how much of it is on the minds of people or on the minds of the mainstream media.
Yeah, just to interject a little bit. I don't know if you saw the like stats comparison between like the Ukraine war and the Amber Heard thing and other big stories. Yeah. Like, Amber Heard, like that was the top. That was the most interest and shares and likes and everything versus like, you know, COVID was near the bottom and Ukraine war was like, you know. So it's interesting.
It's fascinating. Isn't it? Like, before we go into some of the, you know, the details that I have here about the war, like what does that tell you about, I don't know, just human psychology, right? Like, well, what do you make of it?
I think it's crisis fatigue. It's essentially, there's just so much going on that it's like the human mind can't comprehend, like, what, we've got mass shootings over here. We got, you know, it's kind of like, the brain just has to push something out. So essentially, I think that's what's happening. And because the war has been going for so long, it's like
people can desensitize as well because it's just not there anymore. And I think that's also one of the reasons why people don't talk about the existing wars that's been happening for, you know, decades or something in certain areas of the world as much, unless there's something big happening in that area. So you're right. It's crazy to see how especially when you put it down on stats, the fact that Amber Heard's and Johnny Depp's trial is number one, and this isn't there. It's really crazy. But I bring that up because there's been some interesting updates in the sense that EU has agreed to ban Russian oil imports, but with a few exceptions. So that's what. Like the sentence in itself was just very interesting to me, is how we're gonna ban it, but there's a but in there, so we're not completely against Russia just yet because we have our own interests still in there. But just to read that part out, it says the European leaders have ramped up their economic fight against Russia by agreeing to an embargo on the Russian oil and petroleum imports, which will cost Russia $10 billion annually in export revenue, but in a bid to win the approval over Hungary, which warned of catastrophic cost to its economy under a full ban, it carved out a temporary exception for oil delivered by Russian pipelines. So it's trying to protect Hungary, because if they ban completely, Hungary's gonna suffer. I don't know how you get out of that, because if you're so reliant on a particular product from a particular country, do you just then wait for the war to die out and then still continue, or do you make plans for such a big?
Well, yeah. Look, there was a lot of controversy before this war. I think in Germany particularly, because of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and everything.
Yeah,
and just how, you know, it's like, are you sure you want to kind of be so reliant on Russia? Like, if something happens and the geopolitical situation changes, you guys are stuck. So it's kind of like all coming home to roost now. Because essentially Germany is leading the EU. But yeah, like Italy has a large proportion of oil that comes from Russia. So, you know, all of these countries in the EU bloc, they could probably, you know, find a way to find oil from somewhere else. But the key word is expensive. It's not going to be cheap. So I think, honestly, I'm not 100%. I'm not, you know, for Russia or anything, but I'm thinking that they're coming out of this a lot better than what the politicians first envisioned when they started all the sanctions. I think we did talk about the Russian ruble, right? How it was really low, but now it's higher than what it was before.
I don't know if it's over US dollar. But
No, I don't think it's higher than US dollars, but higher than the level it was before the war, which means they're in a better
crazy
position.
That's just incredible.
So I think, you know, Russia, they're going to do deals with India and China, and they're just going to find, I guess, other clients. But yeah, I think it's not as simple as just saying, you know, we're going to ban you, let a bit through. It's like, it's going to be a massive like undertaking to get all the energy that you need in terms of, you know, having this huge component just removed. You can't just do that. So I think they can say that, but it's probably going to be not as smooth sailing as
you want. But it's interesting to know that how, you know, these big corporations and countries just had so many sanctions on Russia to, and then hoped and thought that it's going to stop them or you know, make them cower. But it's just had the complete opposite impact. But it almost feels like because Russia is so big and you know, they have had so many historical or backings of their...
Are you talking about landmass or economy? Because they're quite small.
In terms of population, right. I would say. Economy, not so much. I don't know much about that. But overall, it just seems like they had a plan. They knew it was going to come.
Yeah, Putin isn't that as dumb as people think. Well, I don't know if they think he is. But so he did plan for this, like in terms of like the economic situation. So they're building up gold reserves, selling US dollars. They were making sure that they had like a stockpile just in case something went wrong. In terms of geopolitics, they were making sides and, you know, the payment system, they were developing their own. I think back in 2018, they're already talking with the Chinese and whatever. So they knew there was going to be this multipolar world a long time ago. And I think Putin was planning for an offensive because obviously with the whole NATO thing in Ukraine, it was like, you know, since 2014, they were having skirmishes, but they knew it was going to escalate. So, so I think he planned for this and now it's kind of everyone's seeing that.
Seeing that coming to effect. Here's one sentence that I didn't think I was gonna read, but the Ukrainian band that won the Eurovision sold its trophy to a cryptocurrency exchange for $900,000 and used the proceeds to buy drones for Ukraine's army.
How do you sell a trophy on?
I don't know. That was one of the news that came out just this week, but. It's crazy, like what a sentence.
Yeah,
you know, like you wouldn't have thought this was possible. Like the sentence wouldn't have made sense like 5-10 years ago. What's going on right here?
Yeah, no,
Think 20 years ago.
Yeah, of course. It's
incredible.
I think this is okay. This is totally random, but I think a few weeks ago I was driving, just thinking about random stuff in terms of like technology and what's going on, and I was like. You know, the 2020s are how we thought the 2000s would be in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, like all the future crazy stuff is here now, but we thought that was going to be like, the year 2000. Yeah. It's like now. A sentence like that, it like encapsulates that things are just like, you know, it's just, wild.
There was a meme that went around on Twitter that said that Wordle is the sourdough bread of the Omicron.
I get it.
And then someone said, imagine reading this tweet 3 years ago.
Yeah.
None of it would make any sense.
Omicron, sourdough bread.
But what that entails is basically
everyone was making sourdough bread during the first wave. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was a crazy tweet. But it's you know, the war's going on and I guess we can only get it from the news and see where it's heading from here on. A quick update on the Netflix password sharing bans.
Uh-huh.
So they've been slowly implementing it on certain regions.
Yeah, I think there was some in South America.
That's right. So Peru and a few other countries. But it's caused a lot of confusion. So consumers in Peru said that first they rolled it out, but then there was a lot of mixed messaging because they weren't sure as to how to really implement it because initially they said you can't, like you can only share the passwords within people who lived in your household only, but there was no way to track it.
Right.
But then they were bumping up the fees regardless if they picked up a different login.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people will be using VPNs.
Right.
So it's caused a lot of confusion. They're raising the prices and that was enough for a lot of people to just say, screw this, it's just not worth it, no matter how much deepfake they use on 11. I'm not going to keep my Netflix subscription. That's just, you know, caused a lot of...
unsubscribing.
In South America. And that begs the question as to how they're going to...
Get their way.
Get this. Because they tested it there thinking that that's a lower impact region compared to a few other regions that they'll probably be, you know, have more more subscribers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they tested it there, but the early results aren't good. So
yeah, it's going to be an uphill battle for Netflix. You know, it's good that Stranger Things has come back because that's actually been very successful so far in terms of the numbers. Okay. The biggest since Squid Game, pretty much.
Right.
But yeah, it's like you can't rely on shows like that once in a while to just boost your subscriber rate. So, you know, I think I mentioned this at the end of my video. It's like almost like everything Netflix can try to resolve the issue can make it worse, essentially, because it's like at that point where it's like, you know, apart from making better shows and, you know, whatever, it's going to be quite hard to you know, turn this recent slide around, you know. It's not that Netflix is going to disappear, but it's just, it's going to be not like it was, you know.
Yeah, and we don't want to get too political on this show, as we keep mentioning, but there were a lot of comments on your video as well, and a few other places that I see about Netflix is that, you know, like go woke, go broke or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And what that entails is that they do a lot of shows to please a certain, you know, quote unquote woke demographic, and therefore a lot of the existing customers are fleeing. But I think that's not a true outlook because...
Well, okay, so... Maybe because I've been seeing some stuff about what the CEO was saying to some of the staff, because you know how they walked out on Dave Chappelle's thing and they're making a big fuss.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, they kept Dave Chappelle's.
No, but the thing is, like, it was a struggle within Netflix. But then now the I think it was a CEO or whatever, he like held a, like, you know, press thing and was talking to the staff and was saying, you know, if you're offended by things, maybe you should leave.
Yeah, and exactly. And then he went on and said that if you don't like the content, you're free to go.
But then that shows you that to make that statement, there must be quite a big proportion, not trivial proportion of people in there that would fit this woke, you know, demographic. So I think it's not good for business in a way, because people may think like that in a collective within the group, but then the wider audience of users would be like, well, you know, like this isn't
but I think that comment's also true for, again, you know, if woke was one side and I guess the Dave Chappelle comedy sketch that offends everyone's on the other side. I think they have a catalog that caters to both, and I think that because a lot of people were willing to leave or go on strike after the whole Dave Chappelle situation, where, you know, he was making certain jokes that was very offensive to certain groups. And I think that comment can also be reflected on that side of things, is that, you know, we're going to keep Dave Chappelle's comedy sketches no matter what you think of it. We're going to keep X, Y, and Z here on this side no matter what you think. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm trying to get at is that it's just to, like, how do you deal with this, right? Right. Because you can't please everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think when you start going to the mass level of things, mm-hmm. you'll always start, you know,
bumping against each side.
Yeah. And I think what Netflix has to do is just, I don't know if they shouldn't really pick one over the other or anything like that. But I think at a mass level, whenever you do something like this, you'll always have people who will be offended by one thing or the other, which will impact the company's growth and outlook as well. And it's true for being a creator as well, right? And I'm sure you can attest to some of it as well. Like, even if a topic isn't political,
yeah,
you'll get comments.
In the last video, I mentioned that I had COVID, and then one guy's like, "You had to mention it, didn't you? You know those tests don't work. Did you really have it?" I was like,
"Yeah, like, it's just a simple statement." Yeah. And even if it wasn't COVID that was political, it could be something completely different.
Yeah.
Somebody else might have taken offense to that statement, right? So I think it's hard to really gauge these days, and maybe as a creator, probably easier to stick to your guns. But as a big, massive corporation, which is catering to the mass, I don't know how do you navigate this while still hoping that the bottom line revenues going along.
It really is tricky, and I guess, like, as people get more divisive, it's like the window is narrower and narrower to, like, be in the safe side, I think.
Yeah, so an interesting thing that I shared this week on my Instagram with my friends is that I'm on the look for running shoes. So I was looking at reviews for this specific running shoe, right? And they have the different versions of the same running shoe. And it's like a version 11, and they released a version 12. The difference between the two was they added an extra 8mm thickness, or like stack height or something like that. It's like a new feature that came out. And I was reading the reviews of that shoe, right? Mm. First comment, I couldn't put, like, as soon as I put the shoes on, I couldn't walk. It's hurting my knees. Stupid 8mm feature wrecked this shoe that I loved before. Like, I got the new version thinking it was going to be better, but the one without the feature was way better. Like, screw this. I'm not going to buy this anymore. Comment underneath. Love this shoe. The 8mm made a whole lot of difference for me. This is exactly what I need. I was looking for a shoe all my life, and this one fulfills that. Like, completely different, like, you know, statements within the same, like, one single feature. Like, the company isn't going out and thinking, oh, I'm going to piss this guy off. I'm going to piss that guy off. Yeah. They're just going out and making the thing whatever they think is best for certain people. And I think it's up to us to think, maybe if it's for me, maybe the consumers start thinking differently. And the network just provide us with whatever caters to the people. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a tough one.
There's, you know, the other side of this is where if you don't like, don't watch.
Exactly.
But no one follows that. So.
Yeah. Well, no one's forcing you to watch this, but we are going to force you to listen to this episode. So yeah, watch out.
There's a surprise coming at the end.
So right in the middle of our show, I got this WhatsApp message that says, hi, we haven't been in touch for a long time. I don't know if you can still remember me. So I've sent you a photo of me now. So this is on my notification ticker and I'm scared to click on it.
Do it.
I'm scared to click on it.
Let's do it.
No, it's not it's not a terrible picture. Like, I have to download it. But, you're downloading it.
Why not?
Okay. It's just a random. I don't know this person. Get this one off, but there's definitely a link under there that I'm not gonna click.
I don't know about that.
It says click for a free consultation. Definitely a spam. But we get a lot of these days on WhatsApp, on Viber, on everything else.
Well, I don't so much get messages, it's mainly phone calls and
that's
emails.
A stop for me. There was a week or like a few weeks where I couldn't keep my phone down. Pretty much what's happening to you these days, Gogo. But it was all spam calls and spam messages.
Right.
It's really gone down over the last couple months, I'd say.
Okay. Yeah, it's reduced for me, but I still get them. So.
Yeah. Well, speaking of surprises in the end of the shows, whatever that is, it's no surprise to us that Elon Musk is back in our story.
Yeah.
So there's a comment there who basically said that we should entertain him because he's a fascist oligarch or however you want to frame him depending on your outlook of the world and perspective of him. But I found that comment interesting because, you know, we're not necessarily Elon Musk fanboys. We just cover news that we think is relevant to our audience and relevant to the things we do in our space. So somehow his comments are always end up being relevant.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, I haven't seen heard of this. So tell me what he was talking about.
Yeah. So it's about remote work.
Oh yes, I have heard of this one. But go on. Yeah.
There's a Twitter account that's that leaks. Yeah. What's it called? Internal
emails.
Emails. Emails.
Internal company.
Internal company.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
So what they do is they have like this big company emails that come from these CEOs and stuff that they share with the world. And a couple of emails that came out from Elon that was 2 days ago. Yeah, May 31st. And the subject is, remote work is no longer acceptable. And it was to exec staff to start with. So basically the executives. So it says that anyone who wishes to do remote work must be in the office for a minimum, and I mean minimum, of 40 hours per week or depart Tesla. This is less than what we ask of factory workers. If they're particularly exceptional contributors, blah, blah, blah. Moreover, the office must be a main Tesla office and not a remote branch unrelated to the job duties. So he basically wants everyone at the office, no more remote work. But this was initially to the exec staff. And then there was a follow-up email that says, just to be clear, that was the subject line, just to be clear, he wanted it for everyone. So everyone is required to spend a minimum of 40 hours in the office per week. The office must be where your actual colleagues are located, not some remote pseudo office. If you don't show up, we will assume that you have resigned. The more senior you are, the more visible must be your presence. This is why I've lived in the factory so much, so that those on the line could see me working alongside them. If I had not done that, Tesla would have gone bankrupt. There are, of course, companies that don't require this, but when was the last time they shipped a great new product? It's been a while. Tesla has and will create and actually manufacture the most exciting and meaningful products of any company of Earth. This will not happen by phoning it in. Brutal emails sent around to everyone. And yeah, that's been doing the rounds, basically dividing people as usual. Doesn't sound like a very fun place to work if you're just going in to clock in and clock out. But I don't know, what are your thoughts on
yeah, on this? So it would be interesting to know why exactly he did this. Was it because he was looking at the stats and the numbers and realizing, hey, like productivity is falling off? Or is it just that it's for a morale thing? Like when people are around each other, they seem to work better. I don't know which one of those it is, because there's been some studies saying working from home hasn't been that bad for productivity. In fact, it's helped some people, but I don't know. It would be interesting to know why he's done it, but I can see why people would be, you know, upset over that.
There's a third theory saying that he's basically looking to fire people without severance pay.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Maybe
just saving up on some cash there, but it's and funny thing is, someone shared that, hey Elon, a lot of people are talking about this leaked email. Any additional comment to people who think coming into work is an antiquated concept? And Elon Musk replied, they should pretend to work somewhere else, not at Tesla.
Yeah, that's pretty brutal.
That was pretty brutal. Yeah, and I thought, my viewpoint is that initially when it sent it to the exec staff, I thought it made sense to an extent because, you know, they're the leaders, they're the department heads. Mm-hmm. You should be leading by example. So mm-hmm. I thought that made sense, but only if they had some sort of stake in the company, not if they're just being paid a regular salary, right? I think it has to make sense. You have to be passionate about the product that you're building. If it's your own thing, it'll just automatically come, right? The mm-hmm. fact that Elon was spending, you know, days and nights in the factory beside factory workers is because he's passionate about the product, right? If you don't have that passion, first of all, then it's your fault, Elon, for hiring people who are not passionate. And number two, of not having a certain degree of compensation that makes people willing to work. Because you can't just, you know, expect people to magically be passionate about something you are doing by yourself, right? Yeah. So I think, yeah, initially the exec staff made sense, but it has to come through some terms, in my opinion. And then he sent it to everyone. And that's mm-hmm. where I thought it's breaking down, because the rest of the company will not be as passionate as you. This mm-hmm. is just the truth. It's
yeah. So do you think that, can you see his side, or do you think that it's totally?
I do see his side in the sense that he wants people, like he wants to build great products, right? I don't think he's going out there and be like, no, I want to ruin these 400 people's lives and give them no family time. And this is funny bit where in Super Pumped, the Uber, the story of Uber series, TV show, the CEO goes, this is one small bit where he says, this is the start of a scene, right? He's just walking into an office room and he's like, oh, the next time I hear about those three words, work-life balance. Mm-hmm. And then they go into the another scene, right?
Yeah.
And then that was like a nice kind of addition to how a lot of the CEO think that they don't think work-life balance exists, which again, I agree with if you're the one building stuff, because you have, think of the greatest inventors, artists, musicians, they don't have the work-life balance that we think, you know, a 9-to-5 job would have. But then that's the reason you're the innovator and not the rest of the company, right? Mm. And if you want the rest of the company to behave that way, you have to, first of all, hire people who are passionate. So if you don't hire, that's your fault. Mm. And number two, compensate them enough to make sense for them to not spend time with their family.
Yeah, okay. Well,
that's my take on it, at least.
I just think the only solution is communism. So like communism. So basically communist.
Okay. Straight into a political angle, but okay.
Communist Teslas. So, you know, every worker, you know, is in the same ranking within the company. So, you know, I think that's the only way to fix this.
Yeah, well, there you
that's
go.
That's sarcasm, by the way, sarcasm. I don't know. It's a tough one. I do see that, you know, people should have some flexibility if they want to enjoy their work a bit more. But on the other hand, maybe there's some dip in productivity that we don't know about. So he's trying to shore that up. But
And I think it's interesting you mentioned how there are some data that showed that working from home has improved and for some it didn't. Mm. And I think again, it goes back to the very first episode we did on the Great Resignation, where we spoke about how just very different personalities, different work, you know, levels, different industries require different inputs, right? Mm. I think it's very, very dynamic. It's not something you can paint with just one color. And that's where the differences of people wanting to spend time at home versus people wanting to go to office just comes in. It's just different people work differently. It's just how it is, right? Mm. And I think what the pandemic has shown is that a lot of people do prefer working from home. And I think that was the great shift. And maybe because a lot of people are doing that, he's probably pissed as well on that, is that, I'm paying you not to just...
He just probably sees it as lazy.
Lazy, yeah. And he's mentioned it a few times over the last few months as well, that, you know, people need to start, getting off their couches and do more work. So,
yeah.
I don't know. But it did open up a lot of conversation about remote work. And that's why we brought it up, not because Elon Musk said it. But if you just look up Elon Musk remote work on Google, you'll see, like, so many people just talking about remote work.
Yeah, yeah. But speaking of employees, apparently there's a labor shortage that's still continuing.
Yes, great segue to Google. Well done. So a lot of American companies American industries are suffering from, and I think same around the world. If you just
here
as well in Perth, most isolated capital city in the world. Those who don't know, if you just walk around and you see a lot of staff wanted everywhere. I think part of it is because of COVID. It's happening, so spreading through later than everywhere else. Mm-hmm. Therefore, people are getting sick, not enough employees to cover shifts, blah, blah, blah. But I think in general in the USA, what's happening is...
Just a small point. Yeah. Do you realize how no one says USA anymore? It's always US. But continue.
Yeah.
I think...
Yeah, you're right. But what did I just say? USA?
You said USA. And I was like, that sounds weird.
Interesting. Why do you think that is?
I think it's just because people are going to get offended, but I think it's just that a bit of loss of prestige. It's like, it's the US. It's not the USA, you know? Like,
really? But I thought a lot of people in the USA would say in the US.
Now, but I remember it being more, it was always USA, USA, you know? Like,
yeah, oh, true.
It's
only in sport stadiums though.
US.
I can just picture Simpsons.
Maybe just cut this bit out. I don't know.
No, it's, nothing's offensive here. We're not.
Are you sure? Really, I can feel like rockets coming through the camera lenses.
Not that offensive.
No, but anyway, sorry. Continue. I derailed that.
No, that's fine. This is an interesting part anyway. But in the land of America, there are a lot of swimming pools that are being closed off because there's a shortage of lifeguards. So for Memorial Day weekend, they had a lot of welcome swimmers, but a lack of lifeguards prevented 1/3 of the public pools in the U.S. from opening this summer, according to the American Lifeguard Association. But I don't know why there's a shortage though. It's like, because you mentioned in the start of the podcast, not this, but the first episode, is how big companies are giving out like incentives, like, if you join McDonald's, I'm going to give you an iPhone or something. Or, So even like worldwide, it seems like a trend that's been following for a few months now. It's just not enough workers.
The pandemic related stuff in terms of analyzing what's happening, I think it's one of the hardest things to do because there's like an economic aspect. There's like a social aspect. There's health aspect. But then, they all come together and merge through and like it's always shifting. So it's hard to tell what exactly is causing this. But I assume it's just maybe people trying to change careers, find new stuff, people being, like the COVID era kind of made people reconsider what they wanted to do, I think. And maybe it's just like a lot of people don't want to work in restaurants anymore or restaurants aren't doing that well either. So I don't know. It's hard for me to
pinpoint. Yeah, it's sorry, got the next bit from Morning Brew, which is a newsletter. Maybe we should start on our own newsletter. Who knows? They said the US job openings are outnumbering US job openings are outnumbering unemployed people by a 2-to-1 ratio.
Okay.
And our empowered workers are ditching some jobs for better pay and treatment at others, especially in low wage and seasonal industries. On top of that, critics say that the Biden administration has not moved quickly enough to bring in more seasonal foreign workers through the H-2B visa program, which can help employers' staff to cope up with the summer. So what this has done is actually pushed a lot of focus to getting a lot of teenage workers in the industry, which is probably why they're offering iPhones to entice this demographic in as well. So it kind of makes sense there, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a very US-specific problem, by the sounds of it.
I mean,
in terms of this, the Biden administration
right.
stuff. Yeah.
Well, not necessarily, because I was hearing some things about Australia, like wanting to get, you know, immigrants,
right.
like working immigrants in as soon as possible to like boost up the economy, essentially. So I don't think it's actually just.
So maybe it is a COVID thing, because during COVID, people weren't able to travel, and obviously that has caused, you know, like. The universities, for example, you'd have a whole influx of...
Yeah, that was a huge cash cow.
Yeah, for Australian universities was incredible, right? Yeah. And I think those students would then get into odd jobs, and a portion of them at least, that's missing out for a lot of these industries. So, yeah, you're probably right. It's not just a US thing. It's just a global thing at this stage.
Yeah. So I guess it'll be interesting to see where the dust settles and how this plays out. But
yeah.
Yeah, I think the labor market has literally fundamentally shifted. It's just a matter of figuring out why and how exactly, but it seems different at the moment. Sure. It didn't just bounce back to how it was, not at all.
Another news this week was Sheryl Sandberg, who's the longstanding COO of Meta, previously Facebook, has stepped down after 14 years as chief operating officer. So she'll leave later this year, but will be on the board. She was hired by Mark Zuckerberg, and she was ex-Google at the time. So in 2008, I think she joined from Google, and it was 4 years before Facebook went public. So cashed in some real dough when Facebook went public. The reason why I bring this up is because she's one of the faces of women in tech, and she paved the way for a lot of female representation within, even though the ratio is still way off if you look at Silicon Valley and things of that sort. But she was also, I think, being the CEO of a company like that, well, the focus is on Zuckerberg. I think she deserves a lot of credit and a lot of criticism that comes with Facebook almost equally, or if not, because, you know, the COO is just as involved in a lot of these implementation of the decisions that come through. So in 14 years at a company like that is pretty incredible, I'd say, to build to say from 2008 to 2022.
Yeah.
Pretty incredible.
Yeah.
But then she also faced a lot of, you know, criticism over the period of a time. More recently, and this is what one thing I want to bring up, is in the whole Capitol storm in January, she said that she only did the interview last month where she said it was largely organized on platforms that don't have the abilities to stop hate and don't have standards or the transparency that Facebook has. So basically she's kind of deflecting all the blame off of Facebook because there's a criticism that
Facebook
was the catalyst to that. And again, I bring this up because there's a Texas social media law that was stopped recently by the US Supreme Court on Tuesday, which from taking effect, that intended to push online platforms for removing political speech. So
intended to what?
Punish. Intended to punish online platforms for removing political speech. So basically the law was that if Facebook decided to remove things that they deemed unworthy or negative in anything political, if they removed it, then they would be punished by, it would be a punishable offense, right? Mm-hmm. But the US Supreme Court stopped it. Mm-hmm. So just to read on that again, it would prohibit large social media companies from banning, demonetizing, or downranking posts in Texas specifically based on certain viewpoints which the tech industry would deem inappropriate. But the big tech argued that this could result in harmful content, such as Russian propaganda or any other propaganda. And this law, and similar to ones introduced by other states, could turn into a prolonged legal battle. And this was the first time in a while where the U.S. Supreme Court came in and actually blocked something like this. So I connected the two stories in here because I feel this is a precursor to some things that we probably will see. So what are your thoughts in terms of like these things happening more and more? And do you think it is like, should big tech be put on the check for something like this?
If you're referring to in terms of checking their power, like the government checking social media power, it's a very internal conflict for me because on the one hand, like I'd like companies to be able to, be able to conduct business free of intervention. But I think with something as big as social media, it's no longer just, oh, this is like, you know, any other company, like I make soda cans or I make shoes or something. This is, you're influencing popular opinion. You're influencing how people behave. You're influencing actual politics now. So it's like this is something new that doesn't fall under the regular category of just a company. So I do think that there has to be obviously checks and balances to protect consumers, but also to protect the stability of a nation if it has to be. But I think we always come against this issue of like, where do you draw the line? That's the main thing. It's like, you know, someone says something that is, politically not incorrect, but politically seen as misinformation one day could be proven later to be true. I'm going to get political, probably the most political I've ever been. But I don't know if you remember during the 2020, I think it was a 2020 campaign, where there was the Hunter Biden laptop story. Do you remember about that?
Remind me.
Okay, so basically Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, he had I don't know how to put it, but he was on some extracurricular chemicals, and he would do crazy things, and essentially he had a laptop that he took into a repair store and was out of his mind essentially and kind of left it there. So the repair guy tried to get in contact with him but couldn't, but then ended up passing it on to a journalist, and on that laptop was evidence of corruption. And then,
as in, you're not talking about file corruption.
Sorry?
You're talking about file corruption.
No. Political.
Just to be clear.
Yeah, political corruption. And then I think it was the New York Post, I think, one of those outlets. They published it on Twitter, a whole expose going through it and everything. Obviously, quite a reputable source. But then Twitter, Facebook, all of these, they came out instantly and said, this is misinformation, and they actually banned the New York Post or whoever it was, that news outlet. And people were like, wow, this is crazy. How do you know it's like, misinformation? So there was like people saying, is it not misinformation? Because this was huge implications. And then it got people talking about social media having that power to like, this is a major story. This is like literally like almost impeachable. So then that kind of died down when the election happened and everything. And then it came out later, like in the past like 3 or 4 months, that story was true. Everything was said was true. And then like, Washington Post, everyone was posting, like talking about it, saying like, how could the president do this and know about this? But it's like, I think there was a survey done saying if more people knew about that Hunter Biden laptop story, the election outcome would have been different, because there was like 40% or something said they would vote differently if they knew about that story, but they didn't get to see it because it was taken away. So things like that, that's horrendous. Like, obviously I'm not playing one side, Democrat versus Republican, but this is like, a major story of corruption that was not seen because the social media companies deemed it inappropriate. So things like that really worry me. I think it's such a new field. It's a minefield to sort out, but yeah, there has to be checks and balances, but also social media companies like should be held accountable for stuff like this as well. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see a way out of this either yet. I think because I feel, what if, because there's a lot of smear campaigns as well that go on, right? And again, we had our election just a few weeks back now. And, I'll get tons of ads, tons of stuff that just keeps coming on my feed, try to sway me one way or the other. And I guess it becomes a, like, do you allow everything to just go out, even if it's, because some of it could be very well be propaganda and fake, or do you keep everything off? Because I don't think it can be one or the other, where the you let the social media pick and choose,
right, yeah,
that, you know,
it's,
I'm going to keep
either
this.
All or nothing. I think,
yeah, because these, that, because even if, even then, like, keeping it on algorithm would be difficult because it's such new territory. Like, it's hard for it that to even judge, right? So I think, yeah, it's going to be one or the other. Like, it's either have everything political stay as is, or maybe create a separate section, I don't know, a separate sub-brand that just only has political stuff, right, so it doesn't, you know, interfere with our day-to-day stuff that we get, or keep, you know, everything on without taking everything out, right?
Yeah.
And I think they are doing some things that's good, in the sense that, so right now, for example, if on Facebook, if I see something on my feed with a story, like in like a link, article link, and I want to share it, it comes with a pop-up saying that you haven't read this article. You still want to share.
Yeah, that's good.
So things like that are coming in place right now. And then sometimes they pop, you know, have like pop-ups, oh, this has been disputed by this and this, but this is also agree. But then it's such a big read.
Right. It's like you're almost reading an article.
Almost reading an article. Yeah, it's like, oh, you want, before I share it, it's like, oh, this has been known to be disputed by X, but there's a few other links underneath. This has also been not disputed by Y. So now you got to go and, like, before just sharing a simple link.
But
so,
I kind of like that, though. As long as they're telling you, like, you know, both sides of the story and whatever. Because it's like, you know, we always say, like, when people share something, they're not going to just, like, read up on it and make sure it's right beforehand, yeah, or check the other side. They're not going to do that. No. But if it's given to you right there, there's a higher chance that they may.
100%. And the problem is, this creates friction with experience.
And that's going to reduce.
And that's going to reduce engagement. Yeah. And therefore, so it goes back to the idea that I was going to drive people off the platform, because they'll be like, oh, screw this, I'm not going to read. People's attention spans are smaller, right? They're not going to read, you know, a 5-minute read before sharing something. It's because,
but then again, like, maybe it's how passionate they are about it. Like,
yeah,
if you're like, this is a pressing issue for you, and, like, you know, your friends have been discussing this, you may read that.
Yeah, like I probably would. If you're right, like, in certain topics I wouldn't, certain topics I wouldn't, because, but again, like, how deep is that topic in terms of having, you know, a political outcome or a general outcome as well? And leaving it with people, like, trolls will abuse it as well. Like, on Twitter, have you seen, like, how...
That's the new trend. Everyone's like, sensitive, like, content, yeah.
And you click it and it's like, oh, this picture says otherwise. And it's, yeah, just a picture, yeah, of otherwise.
That's the most common one.
Yeah, yeah.
I've just seen pictures of cats just sitting on a keyboard.
Exactly, yes. And people are just abusing the hell out of it in terms of... What was it, like, reporting it as offensive?
Yeah, or, yeah, yeah.
Like, self-reporting that this could, yeah, have offensive content. Yeah, so, yeah, yeah, dude, this makes it harder as well. So it's like, you've got trolls out there just want to have fun on.
Yeah.
So maybe just remove all the serious stuff out of the platform. It's probably...
Remove all the what?
Remove all the serious political stuff out of the platform.
Yeah, when you were saying that, I was like, that might not be such a bad... So it's like...
Like, one feed that has everything, like, yeah, from... The left, right, center.
Yeah, and it'll be like chaos and people like blowing each other up there.
That's
but it's
it,
like,
that's it. Like, you
can be
take,
away.
Yeah, yeah, just take that shit, yeah, away from our feed.
Call it like Meta Plus.
Yeah. Would Through the Web be there? No.
No.
No, Through the Web will be not, here. We're chill.
Yeah, we're like 1% political. So. Yeah,
1%.
Yes. So I was just looking through my Instagram just then, and apparently LeBron James is officially a billionaire.
Wow.
So I didn't read the story, so I don't know what exactly.
You should have like a breaking news, ding, 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 like a segment.
Damn, son, where'd you find this?
Breaking news. Well, he's talking, the majority is his salary, so $385 million from playing basketball.
Well, of course, you get money from that.
Yeah, but then it's also talking about $300 million from the Spring Hill Company. So I don't know what that is, but yeah, $90 million from... Sports Group and Boston Red Sox, other investments, $80 million from 3 properties, and $30 million for Blaze Pizza. So no mention of Google.
$30 million. Oh, that's interesting.
So, yeah, so I guess just investments and companies there.
Yeah.
So
well, good on him.
Yeah, there you go. Actually, I haven't told this story, but I've met LeBron James.
Oh.
Yeah. So this was 2013. I was in San Francisco on a. Oh, this was after a Contiki tour. So this was just like, me and my mate were just like in a hostel, and then they had a night out, and there was kind of like yeah, we went to this venue and essentially there was a massive line outside, and then the guy with the tour guide was like, oh, make sure you guys have the right shoes. And we're like, what? And then, because when we got up to the front, and then we're like, what? Like, you didn't tell us about this. And it's like, oh shit, I'm sorry guys. And then like, just as we're about to like go, the guy in front of us, we noticed was like super tall and there's a few of them.
Yeah.
And then when we get to the front, like just as we're about to like go, the guy in front is like, oh, don't worry, he's with us. And then we get let in, and then it's like literally one of the, I don't know who it was, but one of their birthdays. So like people going crazy. There was like, you know, people, yeah, it was like a nuts night, but it was like, I wouldn't have believed it if it didn't happen to me. So yeah, that's the story.
Any pictures with it?
I didn't.
Oh, come
he
on,
like
man.
Left. He was oh, like, he was oh, gone. Right, he scooted
right,
out.
Right, and I
was
of course.
Like, oh, oh, damn. So I've only mentioned it. Like if you watch on my YouTube channel, I did a video about that whole trip and I mentioned it there, but yeah.
Oh, so back when Dagogo used to do vlogs.
That's my only, yeah, that's literally my only vlog.
23, if you scroll a lot, like, you know, the wheels are going to go off.
But yeah, maybe another vlog for this trip that I'm going on.
Yeah, so it's tonight, isn't it?
Yeah, so I fly off at 11 p.m. tonight. I'm going to Amsterdam. And yeah, it's for a awards celebration, I guess, of different creators and actors and actresses. And yeah, it's actually interesting. Apparently there's some Grammy people there and whatnot. Wow. So,
well, hopefully you'll meet him again. Just a surprise appearance for coming up to dinner. So, well, good luck on
that. Yeah, thanks.
Just a couple more stories before we finish up.
Yep.
So Ford, the brand, car brand, will transition into exclusively online fixed price delivered to your door sales for electric vehicles.
That makes sense.
So everything will be online.
I think that's, you know, For the brand image of an electric vehicle, it's forward looking, it's the future, et cetera. So it's kind of like an online sale without a middleman. Just you directly to Ford, no dealers, whatever, and delivered to your door. I think that makes sense. The people that are in that category would be more used to buying stuff online. They'll be into technology and all of that. So I don't see.
Yeah, it as a bad move. Basically says that there'll be the they have to go to like, you know, non-negotiated pricing. Will be 100% online, and there will be no inventory at dealerships. So, but wouldn't you say that a part of buying a car is experiencing it first or doing a test drive with an electric vehicle or with a thing like that? Wouldn't that completely?
Yeah, no, you're completely right in that sense. I think maybe it would add to some friction in terms of like buyer. How much the buyer actually is willing to like go into something that they haven't tested before. But I don't know, the Ford F-150 is one of the most popular cars in the US, and I'm sure the electric version will do well. So I'm sure a lot of this will also just come from them riding in their friends' cars or like, you know, having some experience with one and being like, oh, I want one too kind of thing, because like, that's what Tesla did. So I don't see it as that much of an issue. It is, you know, might take away like 10% of sales, but I think still, it's fine.
Brandon here is quite into cars, so we'll probably ask him about this. Yeah, so what are your thoughts on this? Like, do you something you see is a good thing? Because you're a very much traditional car guy.
I hate it. I hate it. But I see why. I get it. But it's as someone who's like into cars, the idea of not going to a car yard and test driving it before buying it seems like a huge problem. I don't know. There's something about driving, you kind of have to feel it first. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. But the reason I say like it probably will work is just how well Tesla's done with that same kind of
model.
Yeah, model, at least in the earlier days.
Would you drive or would you buy a car ever without testing it? Do you see enough reviews and stuff?
Well, I mean, yeah, like it, not a new car. I wouldn't buy a new car.
Okay.
A car that I know that I would want, yeah, 100%, but, you know, they've already been around for a while. But also the Tesla thing, like one of my uncles was looking at a Tesla, and you can actually go and test drive them here. You can't buy it directly from the dealer, I don't think. Or you can put down some kind of lock-in deposit at the moment with the way COVID is, but you can still go and test it.
Right.
So if they had like test vehicles specifically for that purpose at a dealership, then That will make sense.
They're saying that it's literally going to be no inventory at dealerships. Yeah. So,
well, you know, the more that I think about it, like, yeah, I think it is. It is quite an aspect that's it's a big purchase usually. Mm. It's a big ticket item. So, you'd want
to. But I think people who are less likely who want to test drive are probably more likely to buy cars that are not electric vehicles. Mm. So. Yeah, like I'd be okay with that if I have enough reviews.
Yeah, enough you're people, confident in
I'm confident yeah. enough that it's going to be an okay experience. And if I've driven a similar car, like off a mate or something, then I know what I'm getting into.
Let's increase the percentage. Maybe 15% of sales lost. Let's say that.
You and your random numbers. That well, you
just oh, I don't know. You've got to, engineering, you got to put a figure
fair
on
enough.
It. Yeah.
Fair enough.
It's called a guesstimate.
Guesstimate. Yeah. No way to track it though. So. final story of the day. NFTs, back in the stories, that things are bad in that space. But the reason I bring this up, because it's the first instance of insider trading in the world of NFTs. So Nathaniel Chastain, who's the former head of product at OpenSea, which is a leading NFT marketplace, was charged with wire fraud and money laundering linked to the insider trading of NFTs, is the first insider trading case involving digital assets, the Department of Justice has said. It all started last September when OpenSea users noticed something fishy was going on with crypto wallets belonging to Chastain. They were purchasing NFTs right before the assets were featured on the site's homepage and then selling them once their prices had gone typically 2 to 5 times the original amount. Turns out Chastain allegedly chose the NFTs he had purchased to be splashed on the front of the page and then then cashed them at a profit of at least $67,000. Mm. According to the news site, once they were alerted of these transactions, OpenSea basically admitted of the insider trading taking place.
So how was it discovered?
Users were seeing the blockchain that there was lots yeah, of weird okay. activity happening on his wallet.
Well, yeah. So that's as bad as crypto is. That's the good thing about it. You can pretty much just sniff out fraud straight away. You can see exactly where everything went. Very brazen of him to do that.
Yeah, and plus like it's kind of stupid. Like,
yeah,
dude, you're like the head of product at OpenSea.
Yeah, maybe he's just your thinking wallets. No one would notice.
Yeah, but people have time.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Some people have time.
He only profited 67,000.
Yeah, that's what it said. I'm not sure if it's for each NFT, but that was the total profit amount. So I'm guessing
that's the not worth it, man.
I know, not worth it. Leaving it's probably. Oh, so here's the thing. As of March, Chastain has worked on a new NFT project. His charges carry a maximum of 20-year prison term. For 67K. Bro. Crypto bro.
Damn, son. Where'd you find this?
That's the perfect one for that.
That sucks. But related, this is the surprise, everyone. I'm releasing NFTs.
Really? Please don't. You've missed the boat, but like.
I know. So like, honestly, so it actually is true. Like the wheels have been going for like a year. So it's there's been disaster after disaster. And like, you know, I've spent, you know, money on artists and everything anyway. So I'm literally just going to throw it up on there and like.
If anyone wants to buy it.
Not promote it. So so there will be Cold Fusion NFTs, but you would never hear about them. So that wasn't actually what I was going to say. Like for the surprise, I just made it up.
It's you even
watched it is true, but I made up the surprise thing. Yeah, go on.
No, but you even watched The Office, have you?
Oh no, not really.
No, okay, yeah. So there's this really funny episode where Michael Scott, who's the the main guy, he keeps saying. Oh, it's going to be a surprise. It's going to be a surprise for like the whole day. It makes the entire office wait till 5 p.m. And there's this really awkward scene towards the end of like a few minutes. Everyone just surrounding around him. It's like, so what's a surprise? And he just goes like, this is the surprise. He doesn't say anything. And then it goes again. It's just so awkward and cringe. And
was there anything?
No. Oh. Everyone just started walking away. It was really... It's cringe and sad.
Right. So you're relating that moment to
you.
Then. Well, look, NFT.
But at least you have something.
Yeah, something. So.
Yes, we'll see.
You maybe see it. It's not even on OpenSea. It's on Niftify, which is another platform. But look, it's a long story. So
fair enough. Well, that was the stories we have. We have a few questions from our listeners. The first one's from Vic. which you want
to
talk about?
Let me find it. So the question is, episode 13 is great. I've got a question. Alphabet Inc. had shut down its internet balloon company, Project Loon, in 2021. I found this an amazing idea back then. However, it would not be able to compete with Elon Musk's Starlink. As we know, Elon offered the Starlink service to Ukraine during the war. What's your opinion? Will Alphabet Inc. ever be competing with Starlink or OneWeb or Amazon's Project Kuiper? So, I think I did a video on that back in 2016 or something. And I think this was part of like Google X. So that was like Google's experimental side of things. And that was back when they were like, you know,
doing a lot of crazy stuff.
Yeah, just crazy. But I think it's times have changed, I think, for a number of reasons. Like Google is, they were mature then, but are more mature now. And I think, you know, especially with their stock price dipping, which all of tech is essentially, they're going to be super sensitive to what investors are perceiving or thinking about what they're doing. So I think projects like this are less likely to continue, mainly because it takes a lot of capital investment to get any return, and that return could be a long way away. So it's like, we might as well just do something else that can get us a return quicker. That's my opinion on it. But also, I think that also, that Google is kind of notorious for like axing products anyway.
Yes.
So it's like they're the worst company that you would think would bring up something back from the dead. But so I don't know what's going on with Web One or Amazon's project, but I'd say Google definitely isn't going to be a competitor in that space. I think those other companies can just eat the lunch.
Fair enough. Next one's from Dipesh Mohotra, and he wants us to talk about Silicon Valley, the TV show. And
this is your domain.
Decentralized internet. It is, but I think it's hard to talk about it like in general. Like, you know, like it's not really a question per se. But
okay. Is he talking about the concept of a decentralized internet?
That's right. That's right. So maybe something we give our opinion on.
Okay.
Well, Silicon Valley for the show, first of all, good show. Yeah. You should watch it. The ending was a bit iffy for me. There's this great character that they axed for a couple seasons. That's when it started feeling a bit iffy. But as long as that character was there, the show was great. So okay. Good watch if you're interested in the world of tech. But yeah, decentralized internet.
Decentralized internet. I'm just trying to imagine how that would work. So everyone would have a host. How would that work? Would you have like, would it be like a blockchain kind of thing where like all the data, but that would be huge. That would be absolutely huge to store.
I don't know how it would scale. So in the show, they did have like some technical ways of explaining that. Can't remember it right now.
Yeah.
But it was through like these devices that you can carry and basically start, you know, like scale it as a direct to consumer product.
Right.
But again, I don't know how that might scale in today's world, but I don't think it's a far-fetched idea either.
Right. Well, I'd have to think about and like listen to the technical details of the decentralized internet, but let's just say it does work. How does it impact society in a way? It would be quite interesting because you wouldn't be able to, like the Great Firewall of China, for example, wouldn't be able to exist, but maybe they're probably still locked away. But you would have some interesting things that would come out of that. Like you wouldn't be able to block people from accessing certain sites. And actually, there was I think there was a project that actually kind of tried to do that in a way. So it was like you could comment on anything. So it was like it had its own – oh, man, I wish I could remember properly. But, yeah, it was kind of like its own service that you could install as a browser plugin to enable you to comment stuff that you shouldn't normally be able to, because, like, a lot of news sites were getting rid of their comment sections or, you know, whatever. But this just allowed, commenting on anything. Oh. So it, like, created this decentralized, like, community around, like, just whatever. So it was, like, a little bit of that. But then it got shut down for some reason. I can't remember why. I think it would be maybe good. A decentralized internet could be a good thing. We'd probably still get all the chaos, but there'll just be less, you know, power.
Yeah, we'll probably have to kind of do a bit of more research
on that one.
Sorry, Dipesh. But I think we'll probably do a bit more research and come back on that topic. It's an interesting topic for sure. The final question is from Rashik Rash. Since you guys have done a dozen episodes in, how has the experience of creating a podcast been so far?
Well, it's been pretty cool. Like, it's kind of like, yeah, you get more comfortable just talking about whatever. And yeah. It's cool to see that people are out there that are listening and have things to say and whatnot. So I'm kind of excited just to see how things progress and, just growing this and seeing where it goes. I think it's overall, I could say, sum it up in one word, is positive. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'd say so too. It's not my first podcast project. Mm-hmm. So it's been all of them have been very different experiences, and this one has been very, very good as well. In the sense that, you know, as you said, it's quite exciting to see the community build. Mm-hmm. I love making things from scratch. So just the first conversations we had a few months ago, to the point of, you know, bring Britain into the whole thing and getting a studio, the whole, I really enjoy the process of building stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great to see that people are connecting to what we have to say. The next challenge is building this community even bigger and tighter.
Mm-hmm.
And once we get to that, I think we'll be satisfied. We don't have to beat Joe Rogan per se. And as I mentioned, it is a bit of a meme to have like two guys talk about the podcast bros talk about stuff, but it's we decided that we liked doing this, not just because it's a trend. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the most important thing. Yeah. It's just we enjoy doing this stuff, and it's not because we are here to catch on trends and stuff. Yeah.
No, and I think it ties in perfectly because, like, you know, whenever I make a video, there's so much else to talk about. But also, like, we just talk about this kind of stuff happening all the time. It's like,
might as well just do this. And that's how a lot of the things start anyway. So, here's to 100 episodes and more, and we'll see where we go from there. That's the end of the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys, for tuning in. And we'll see you again soon for the next episode.